from the Witherspoon Concert Hall in Omaha's Joslyn Memorial, KIOS-FM proudly presents another program from the Utihaly Lecture Series. We'll hear a talk given by educator, musician, and award-winning author and record producer John Hassey, the curator of American music at the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian Institution. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, November 14, 2005, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Utihaly Girls Village, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce today's speaker is Carolyn Orr, chairman of the Utihaly Lecture Series Board.
Now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. John Hassey. As our program states, Dr. Hassey is an educator, musician, award-winning author, and record producer. He serves as the creator of American music at the National Museum of American History, located in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Now, just for a moment, take a little trip with me in Iowa. Go north on I-29. You'll encounter Sioux City, Iowa. Stay on the interstate. Drive a little bit over the South Dakota line. Drive about 30 miles. And you'll find Vermilion, South Dakota. And that's where Dr. Hassey grew up. So we want to give him a very warm Midwest welcome.
Thank you, Carolyn, for that lovely and generous introduction. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so honored to be with you. And I want to salute this wonderful organization. Last evening, I had a chance to go to the Utihaly Girls Village and spend an hour with the young ladies there. And I was so impressed with their attentiveness, their generosity, in some cases, their amazing maturity. And they asked terrific questions. And I really think this organization is doing wonderful work. And I salute the council for your support. Let's give Utihaly a big hand. It's an honor also to be in this wonderful Joslyn Art Museum. I was here many years ago and gave a performance for the Bagels and Box series on Sunday morning. Actually, I think I did two of them some time ago, but I'm really pleased to be back in this beautiful museum. It's a real treasure of Omaha, among many other treasures, including the New Holland Performing Arts Center. I'd like to see a show of hands. How many of you play a musical instrument or sing or used to? Most of you. Well, then you may know that people who play one musical instrument often like to poke fun at people who play another musical instrument. For example, what do a bagpipe and a hand grenade have in common? By the time you've heard it, it's too late. You know why bagpipe players walk while they play? They're trying to get away from the sound, too. Well, everywhere you go in the world, you hear American music.
Mm-hmm. I just want someone that I can talk to. I want you just the way you are.
It's one of our most pervasive exports. It's better known and loved than American art, American theater, American dance, American literature. In China, American music is so popular that they make bootleg copies of our CDs. In South Africa, you can find teenage boys on a street corner singing American songs by memory and even fading out at the end like they do on our recordings. In a dusty village in East Africa, a safari guide, remembering the old Hoagy Carmichael songs, looks up and calls it an old buttermilk sky. In a little village in Switzerland where I have been, they have an annual festival of New Orleans music, and there are bands of Italians playing Dixieland, swaggering down the street. And in Japan, they have bluegrass bands that sound uncannily like the real American thing. Now, why have I titled my talk The Triumph of American Music? Three reasons. First, American music has triumphed in our daily lives. Tens upon tens of millions of people devote time every day to participating in our music, whether as listeners or performers. American music is one of the most popular pursuits in modern society. Second, American music has triumphed around the world. Our American music boasts such vitality, variety, and creativity that throughout the 20th century and now into the 21st century, people throughout the country and the world have found it irresistible. And third, when future historians look back on our era, I believe they will judge the high points of American music as ranking among the greatest achievements of 20th century America. Today, I've selected 17 or 18 of these high points, which I will share with you via recorded excerpts and several live demonstrations at the piano. What makes American music unique? Above all, it's the mixing of musical traditions rooted in Africa with those rooted in Europe, the coming together of music from two old world continents here in the new world that's made our music here in the United States sound different and unique. I'm not going to go back to the very beginning, but if we go back to the 19th century, we found that during the Civil War and afterwards, every community of every size or pretension had to have at least one marching band or military band. By the 1890s, when John Philip Sousa wrote The Stars and Stripes Forever, the martial tone of this piece resonated with a national optimism and growing economic and military might. Here's my favorite passage in all of Sousa, the famous piccolo solo from The Stars and Stripes Forever. Gosh, a couple notes higher and only a dog could hear that. In the 1890s, ragtime music, percussive as the banjo, played on the ubiquitous piano at its best virtuosic and irresistible, burst upon the scene. After spirituals, ragtime was the first truly kind of American music. It was developed by black musicians exercising their newfound freedom in the years after the Emancipation Proclamation. The essence of ragtime was syncopation, tricky rhythms, and a percussive attack, all qualities of African-derived music. Yet it was performed on that most quintessentially European of all musical instruments, the complicated and expressive piano. And it only could have been created here in America. To everyone's surprise, Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag of 1899 became a big seller as teenaged boys and girls struggled to master its difficult rhythms and big leaps in the left hand. This is a very difficult piece to play because of those large leaps in the left hand and because the two hands are doing completely different things. Completely, they're almost at war with each other. Anyway, they're not talking to each other. And if you play it at anything but a very, very slow tempo, it's just very challenging. It's so difficult that it became a test piece among professional pianists. They would challenge each other with this piece to see who was the best. So with a little gulp, I'm going to go to the piano and give you an interpretation of Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag. Of all the figures who enter into the story of American music, do you know whom I single out as the most important? It wasn't a composer. It wasn't a songwriter, a performer. It wasn't a conductor. Anybody want to guess? Who? No? Anybody else? Nope. It was an inventor, Thomas Edison. He ranks as the single most important figure in American music, in my judgment, because his invention, the phonograph, transformed our musical experience. Ultimately, of course, music is not notes on a page. It's sound. It's musical sound. And that's why Edison's invention is so important. It captured the actual sound of music making. The phonograph record made music sound repeatable. It made musical sound portable, and it made musical sound widely accessible over time and space. Edison's phonograph gave impetus to the rise of new bodies of American music. These are new kinds of music in which the composer is less important than the performer. New bodies of music like jazz, blues, gospel, country, bluegrass, rock and roll, R&B, and soul. Now, if ragtime music was beyond the pale for many who prided themselves on middle-class respectability, so was the blues. Lots of parents used to say, "Get that ragtime out of my house." It was the rock and roll of its day. Now, the blues was another expression of African Americans, and it came up in the Deep South in the years after the Civil War. The most authentic blues, however, would remain largely unknown to white Americans until the 1920s, when the real thing began to be recorded. Bessie Smith, a magnificent singer from Chattanooga, Tennessee, brought diction, expression, and great depth of feeling to this form. In my judgment, she has never been equaled. She wrote this next song in 1927 as if to signal a premonition. It's about a great flood, and 2 months later, the Mississippi flooded as it has never flooded since. The Great Flood of 1927, A million people lost their homes. 100,000 people died. She's accompanied here by the great James P. Johnson on piano. Listen to a little bit of her Backwater Blues.
Backwater blues, done caused me to pack my things and go. Backwater blues, done caused me to pack my things and go. Cause my house fell down and I can't live there no more. I can't move no more. I can't move no more. There ain't no place for a poor old girl to go.
It was in 1914 that W.C. Handy wrote not only his most popular piece, the St. Louis Blues, but this piece went on to become one of the most recorded songs in history. By some rankings, it ranks number 3 behind Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust and Lennon and McCartney's Yesterday. There are at least 500 recordings of the St. Louis Blues. One of the reasons it's been so tremendously popular is it's a rich blues. There are 3 separate sections. And in the middle section, you hear echoes of Spanish music. Handy had spent a little time in Havana, Cuba, in 1900, and you hear a little bit of that habanera rhythm, named for Havana, in it. And the third section is, well, it's almost like a boogie-woogie to come. So I'm going to play you W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues. I'll play the 3 sections, and after I get to the 3rd section, I'll launch into my own improvisation on the St. Louis Blues.
Thank you.
a great jazz drummer, Buddy Rich. We have his drums, by the way, at the museum. Was once being examined by his doctor. "Are you allergic to anything?" the doctor said. "Country music," said Buddy Rich. Now, some of us are allergic to country music and some of us love it. How many of us are allergic to country music? A few? How many of us like it? Okay, all right. During the 1920s, not only did the blues first appear on record, but so did a music that had come up from rural white America that was rooted in the Anglo-American ballads and dance tunes that found persistent popularity in the hills and hollers of Appalachia. The music was at first called old-time music. Later, they called it country and western music, and finally, just country music. Jimmy Rogers, the so-called singing brakeman, and the Carter family were early pioneers. In a short-lived career, singer, songwriter, guitarist Hank Williams wrote and sang dozens of songs that would become classics of country music and of American music. Here's a song of his that evokes good food and good times down along the bayous, but you don't have to be Cajun or from Louisiana to enjoy this piece or to get it.
Goodbye, Joe, me gotta go, me oh my oh. Me gotta go, pull the P-Row down the bayou. My Yvonne, the sweetest one, me oh my oh. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou. Jambalaya and a crawfish pie and a filet gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see Mama Shazamio. Pick it up, fill fruit jar and be gay, oh. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou.
Dizzy Gillespie once said of Louis Armstrong, "You can't play anything on your horn that Louis didn't play." Louis Armstrong. What does that name conjure up for you? A handkerchief dabbing entertainer singing Hello Dolly? Well, that was one very important part of Louis Armstrong, the consummate entertainer. The other side was Louis Armstrong, the New Orleanian, who was an innovative musician and who, as a young man, revolutionized jazz and changed American music forever. Armstrong brought entirely new rhythmic conceptions, a bravura style of playing and singing, an individuality of sound, and a brilliant ability to improvise, to compose spontaneously on the spot, night after night after night. He transformed jazz from a group art into a soloist art and changed American music. His contributions, I think, can be summarized in what I like to call the five S's. By example, by his brilliant example, he taught other musicians, not only in jazz, but in all kinds of music, how to sing, how to swing, how to scat, how to solo, and how to stamp their material with their own individuality. He taught other musicians how to take something old and familiar and to turn it into something new and fresh and exciting. Listen to me now, to the way back in 1931, Armstrong takes the melody of Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust and transforms this familiar piece into something wholly new, something entirely his own, that is Louis Armstrong's own.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend such lonely nights. Oh, baby, lonely nights. Dreaming of a song, melody, memory, and I'm once again with you. When our love was new, oh, baby, each kiss an inspiration. Now that, baby, you know, long ago. Oh, beside a garden.
Nobody makes music like Americans do. Building on the success of Stephen Foster and other pioneering songwriters of the 19th century, a new generation of songwriters came to center stage in the 20th century. George Gershwin began by writing ragtime piano and then achieved a brilliant career, as we all know, by composing jazz-influenced popular songs, musical comedies, and a grand opera, Porgy and Bess, and other concert works as well. In his piano concerto, Rhapsody in Blue, he synthesized European symphonic forms with interpretations of American jazz. Here is a little reminder of that very familiar piece, Rhapsody in Blue, and I'm going to play that most famous glide in all of American music, clarinet glide from Rhapsody in Blue. I mentioned that Gershwin wrote an opera, a grand opera. It's from 1935, set in Charleston, South Carolina, Porgy and Bess. The piece gave us many standards that have been adopted by jazz performers and popular singers, none perhaps as popular as Summertime, the lullaby that opens the opera, and that scene on the far right is from the movie version of Porgy and Bess. I'd like to offer you my own interpretation of George Gershwin's Summertime. Thank you. Meanwhile, while Gershwin was still in his prime, other composers in the 1930s, such as Aaron Copland, were exploring what it meant to be an American through their music. Sometimes it meant mining the rich motherlode of regional musical traditions, as when Aaron Copland built an entire piece, Appalachian Spring, around a 19th century Shaker hymn, "'Tis the Gift to be Simple." Nobody writes music like Americans do. By the way, it really kills me to have to cut all these pieces off after such short excerpts, but we have a lot of ground to cover this morning. Once Mrs. Oscar Hammerstein, wife of the great lyricist, was said to have overheard someone remarking that in Old Man River, composer Jerome Kern had written a great song. "I beg your pardon," said Mrs. Hammerstein, "but Mr. Kern didn't write Old Man River. Mr. Kern wrote Dum, 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 Dum. My husband wrote Old Man River." When composer Jerome Kern and lyricist Oscar Hammerstein II teamed up to write Showboat in 1927, they made musical history. With its treatment of realistic themes and its breaking away from traditions of operetta, it was the most significant musical, Broadway musical, to its day. The song Old Man River shows some of their magnificent gift for lyric and melody, as sung here by the great William Warfield. A few years ago, I had the great honor of bringing William Warfield on board with me on the Delta Queen steamboat. As we plied the Mississippi River, I was directing a series of cruises on the theme Music of the River, and he gave a wonderful presentation on his years working in Showboat and in Porgy and Bess. And when he got up to sing Old Man River, here we were, the Mississippi was going by on both sides of us, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And when he finished, the audience, as one, leapt to its feet to give him a standing ovation. I'll never forget that moment. Sometimes Americans have celebrated their native land in glorious songs, such as this next song. And other than America the Beautiful, this is my personal favorite as a great American patriotic song, as a hymn to America, really. This Land Is Your Land, composed by the itinerant songster from Oklahoma, Woody Guthrie.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Between World Wars I and II, Americans took up social dancing as never before in ballrooms and dance halls all across the country. How many of you have danced to the big bands? Quite a few of you. Okay. Well, the craze for dancing helped drive the popularity for dance and swing bands, and vice versa. See if you recognize this next piece.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. It don't mean a thing. All you got to do is sing.
Anybody know the band leader? It was Duke Ellington. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing, 1932. This piece was prophetic because while he recorded it in 1932, 3 years later, the word swing was on, suddenly it seemed, everybody's lips as the swing era was born. I should mention here that the Smithsonian is proud to preserve Duke Ellington's entire archives, 200,000 pages of documents, half of that unpublished music that he wrote for his band. Can you imagine the thrill we felt? It would be like acquiring 100,000 pages of Beethoven's unpublished music. And it's now all belongs to you, the American people. We're merely the custodians of it at the Smithsonian. Now, after World War II, the big band era was eclipsed by the era of the big singer, as the singers who had sung with the big bands broke away and went out on their own, such as Frank Sinatra here on the right, who had been singing with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. By the way, this coming Saturday marks the centennial of band leader and trombonist Tommy Dorsey. Frank Sinatra, heartthrob, matinee idol, gifted movie star, controversial public figure, but ultimately important as one of the great interpreters of American song. He knew better than almost anyone how to take a lyric and, through his singing, act out its meaning. He could take a 3-minute song and turn it into a virtual 3-act play. Here he takes the rarely heard 16-bar verse of Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust and turns it into a 1-act.
And now the purple dusk of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, the little stars climb, always reminding me that we're apart. You wander down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday, the music of the years gone by.
Nobody interprets music quite like Americans do. Of mid-20th century musicals, besides Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma, Another one that stands out is the Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim collaboration from 1957, West Side Story. From this reworking of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, let's listen to this excerpt from the love duet, Tonight.
Tonight, tonight, it all began tonight. I saw you and the
a miracle would happen. I know now I was right.
For here you are, and what was just a word is a star.
And now to our last recorded example of the morning. In the 1950s, a young singer who had moved from Tupelo, Mississippi, that's right, to Memphis, yes, Elvis, synthesized country music and blues. Essentially, he made R&B music accessible to a wide audience of white teenagers, created unprecedented excitement and fervor with his sound, and helped launch rock and roll music as the most commercially successful music, not only in America, but in the world, of the last half century. From the first three chords, if I didn't have the image of this, I'm sure you'd recognize it. Three chords, maybe two chords. Two chords. We got a dance floor back there or something. All right. And now I'd like to play one final piece for you at the piano. While we're on the subject of rock and roll, one of the great songwriting duos of the 50s and 60s was Lieber and Stoller out of New York City. And they gave us a piece named for a town about 3.5 hours south of here. It was recorded by the Beatles and many others. It became a rock standard. This is Kansas City.
Thank you.
In conclusion, there are economic, social, and cultural reasons that American music has triumphed around the world. But as you've heard this morning, the real reason is the extraordinary vitality, vibrancy, and expressivity of the sound of Americans composing, singing, and performing. It's one of the great things about this country, I think. It's unique, for truly nobody makes music like Americans make music. Our music sums up so much about this country, our aspirations and our feelings, our dreams and our pastimes, our diversity and our strength, our creativity and our character. That is why we can speak of the triumph of American music. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Utihalee Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by educator, musician, and award-winning author and record producer John Hasse, the curator of American music at the National Museum of American History at the Smithsonian Institution. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, November 14, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Randy Figura and Brian Sylvester for their help in the recording of this program. Special thanks also to Tracy Wells for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture in the series will be Monday morning, April 10th, 2006, at 11 o'clock. The guest speaker will be terrorism survivor Jackie Flug, author of Miles to Go Before I Sleep. If you'd like to attend this or other lectures in the series, call the Utihalee Girls Village at 453-0803. Tickets for this lecture will be available at the door the day of the event. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.